Good evening, Truth Seekers. Malloy here on Nova M, the Progressive Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in, however you're doing that tonight. I know, it gets harder and harder to find this program, doesn't it? Well, not too much longer, trust me. Eventually, it'll be easier and easier. We do not have an uplifting program tonight, but we have one that I think you'll find intense enough to stick around for. Among the less upsetting items is the announcement today by Tony Snow that today was his last day. America bids farewell to Tony Snow, at least as press spokesgeek for the most criminal administration in the history of this republic. He's leaving his post as White House spokesliar to go make more money. That's what he says in an interview, a couple of interviews. He said he needs more money. I'm not sure what that means. It's clearly obvious that Tony Snow is in the fight for his life where it concerns his metastasized colon cancer. If one of the ways of fighting that colon cancer is to go make more money, okay. And if it's not, okay. I'm sure Tony Snow has a family. Perhaps he wants to leave them something when he dies. I know I certainly do when I die. Probably the most honest thing he said in his entire career, including his time at Fox News, was the fact that he wanted to go make more money. And again, if that's how Tony Snow deals with his impending mortality, good for him. You know, whatever gets you through the night, especially the sort of nights that Tony Snow is having right now, I'm sure. I had a brother die of metastasized colon cancer, and it is not pleasant. So, you know what that means. Speedy Perino, the Valley Girl, and Ann Coulter wannabe will now be conducting whirlwind briefings. Break out your espresso machines. It's going to be hard to keep up with lightning lips. Too much cappuccino Perino. Oh, it's going to be fun, isn't it? Okay, it's not going to be fun, is it? We have to report to you, a lot of folks sent me emails about these two deaths today. Two of the seven soldiers who wrote the op-ed piece for the New York Times, taking issue with what the Bush crime family and the military leadership in this fractured, destroyed United States military had been saying. These seven non-commissioned officers, on their own, wrote this, submitted to the New York Times. It was published. Two of those soldiers are now dead, and a third, of course, was shot in the head, is still alive, but in, critical but stable condition. The shooting occurred, I think, a day after the article was written. The two soldiers who died were killed in what is described as a vehicle accident in Baghdad on Monday. And of all the people who emailed to me about this story, Mary in Denver wrote, "Mike, this is truly horrible. Two of the soldiers who wrote the August 19th New York Times op-ed, The War As We Saw It, died in a, quote, vehicle accident, end quote, in Baghdad on Monday. One of the others has been hospitalized with a head injury for several weeks. I have no doubt that the remaining four are in greater jeopardy than the average cannon fodder unit in Iraq. I despise," Mary writes, "living in a land ruled by murderers." Yeah, so do I, Mary. So do I. The the father of Omar Mora, Robert Capitillo, said he never read, this is from an editor and publisher online, the dad said he never read the controversial column his son co-wrote with six other Iraq-based soldiers for the Times, but when he heard about it, he only had praise for his son. Capitillo told editor and publisher today, just 2 days after Moore, an Army sergeant, and his fellow comrade, Yance Gray, were killed in Baghdad, dad said, "Everybody has a right to speak out. We all have a right to. We all have a right to speak out what we feel. There are personal feelings, and that's a right here that we all have. End quote. The other father, the father of Yance Gray, Richard Gray, offered similar views on his son's part in the column. He said, quote, "I thought it was well written, and there wasn't anything in it I disagreed with that situation over there," end quote. He said this in a phone interview from his home in Montana. Among the statements in the column published last month were, quote, "In short, we operate in a bewildering context of determined enemies and questionable allies, one where the balance of forces on the ground remains entirely unclear," end quote. The column drew a strong reaction from the Pentagon, but as far as anyone knows, these soldiers were not publicly punished. Or were they? This is where Bush and his killers have left me. I find out that two soldiers die in a combat zone. Normally that would be a tragedy, but one that one expects from soldiers who are in a combat zone. But then you find out it's being identified as a vehicle accident, and the two soldiers involved were two heavy-duty critics, without disrespecting their uniforms or the U.S. military, heavy-duty critics of the policies and directives that took them and 160,000 other soldiers into this cauldron of death and destruction. And when you find out those additional facts, other than two soldiers died in a combat zone, I have to stop now and think about that. Because I understand the murderous qualities, if that's how they can be described, of this corrupt Bush crime family. They will kill anyone who gets in their way. Anyone. As they have shown over their entire history, not just the Bush crime family, but the Bush blood family. Now, the deaths of these two soldiers, moving on here before I get too paranoid and too deeply embedded in my tinfoil hat, the deaths of these two soldiers are hitting the editorial page editor of the New York Times, Andrew Rosenthal, with particular velocity. Rosenthal said, quote, "It brings it home, and it reminds you how distant most people are from this war." He said it would be ludicrous to say that this war has now touched us, but it has in a way. Rosenthal said that the deputy editorial page editor, David Shipley, handled arrangements with the soldiers to have the op-ed published, including making sure they were comfortable with what would have been the likely negative reaction. The soldiers all said, according to Shipley, from the get-go, that they did not want to be paid. Normally freelance columnists, so you get several hundred dollars for a column like that. He said it was a statement from them. Rosenthal added, "It was a really wonderful piece, we thought. I'm proud of them. I thought it was great and what the op-ed page is for. We had heard they got some grief from bosses about writing about this, but this is the 21st century and people communicate with each other. Not every soldier in Iraq buys this Potemkin war that they are selling." Rosenthal added that their deaths drive home the impact the war continues to have on individuals, even with all the talk of, oh yeah, we'll pull out sometime. Rosenthal closed by saying, quote, "How many American lives, how many Iraqi lives are enough?" End quote.
Lighting these fires, these bombs. We don't know what's gone wrong. You're listening to Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
Past the hour. So here's a letter that Barbara Boxer has written to Bush today concerning those two dead non-coms who wrote the among the seven who wrote the piece for the New York Times. And thanks to our North Metro Atlanta correspondent, Sharon, our military correspondent. Boxer writes, "Dear Mr. President, I've just learned the heartbreaking news that Staff Sergeant Yance Gray and Sergeant Omar Mora, two of the seven American soldiers who authored the August 19 New York Times op-ed titled The War as We Saw It, were killed near Baghdad this week. The tragic irony is that before their deaths, these two soldiers were not only trying to give us direction on how to end this war honorably, but they were also calling on us for help. At the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing yesterday, I read to General David Petraeus this passage from their op-ed, quote, "We need to recognize that our presence may have released Iraqis from the grip of a tyrant, but that it has also robbed them of their self-respect. They will soon realize that the best way to regain dignity is to call us what we are, an army of occupation, and force our withdrawal. Until that happens, it would be prudent for us to increasingly let Iraqis take center stage in all matters, to come up with a nuanced policy in which we assist them from the margins, but let them resolve their differences as they see fit," end quote. Boxer then goes on, "I hope you will follow this advice and institute a new policy in which the Iraqis take center stage in defending their own country, thus avoiding the stigma of occupation that is now attached to our troops. This would allow for the immediate redeployment of the vast majority of our soldiers. I also ask that you reconsider your decision to extend the surge for another year. If you insist on extending the surge, it should be done with the Iraqi security forces. The U.S. taxpayers have spent $20 billion to train more than 350,000 Iraqi security forces in counterinsurgency. Surely, there are 30,000 Iraqis that are up to the task of securing their own country. Mr. President, you didn't listen to Staff Sergeant Yance Gray and Sergeant Omar Mora while they were alive. I hope that you will listen to them now as they have paid the ultimate sacrifice for our country. Sincerely, Barbara Boxer, United States Senator." Now, I know, I can hear your cynicism all the way out there in radio land, and I certainly share it. George W. Bush will use that letter from Barbara Boxer as bathroom tissue. In the same manner that he referred the U.S. Constitution as a, quote, goddamn piece of paper, end quote. This man's a sociopath. It doesn't make any difference how many people die. Oh, he can get teary. He can hug the moms, as he puts it. He can get all beklempt and upset when he has to deal with the death that he's causing, even in the remote way that he deals with it. But watch the big show tomorrow night. And by the way, we'll probably carry it live on the Malloy program here. Bush is due to speak at 9 o'clock. And you can rest assured that in that talk that he's going to give, the speech he's going to give, written by, to a large extent, Cheney, and some of these murderous sons of bitches who should be taken out and put on trial for their war crimes and then dealt with accordingly, Bush will blame everything on those dirty, rotten, filthy Iranians. Those dirty, rotten, filthy Iranians and maybe the Syrians too, but especially those dirty, rotten, filthy Iranians. It's their fault. And since it is their fault, and since they are doing cross-border incursions to murder our soldiers, then, well, by God, you know, huh? What you say? We've got to react. That's what his speech is going to be about tomorrow. I got an email from James in Seattle. Oh, and by the way, yes, I do have the articles about what Central Command Chief Admiral James Fallon what he, William Fallon, what he feels about Petraeus. And I can't use his all of what he said on the air because the language is language that is not allowed on the public airwaves. If I were strictly on Sirius or strictly on Nova M, I could give it to you verbatim. But I'm not, and I can't. But we will come as close to it as we can. And by the way, you may be surprised, as I was, to find out Admiral William Fallon's position on two things, the surge and war with Iran. Admiral Fallon refused to send a third battle group, naval battle group, to the Persian Gulf because he saw it as a provocative against the Iranians. That's A. Here's B. He said that a war with Iran will not occur on his watch, which is a pretty direct statement that he will resign if the Bush crime family pushes an invasion of Iran. Now, this is a real eye-opener for me today. I'll share it with you when we come back. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
We are redefining war on our terms.
You're going to be redefined, Mr. Bush, eventually. You really, really are. There is justice still in this country. It's just temporarily in a coma, but you're going to be redefined. James in Seattle wrote the following. I had to change just a couple of words here, and James, sorry, but we do a little editing sometimes when we get emails. James writes, the other day I happened to browse through an incredibly poorly written and even more poorly researched book on recent history about Nixon and China by a writer who fraudulently identified herself as a historian. She happened to mention that Nixon had halted the Christmas bombing of Hanoi during the later stages of the American war in Vietnam. Wrong. I was serving in the military at that time in Vietnam and later at the command level, where I witnessed the real history of events, not the revisionistic history that we are being fed today. The B-52 bomber pilots staunchly refused to fly any more missions bombing the civilian population in North Vietnam. Around that period, late 1971 and throughout 1972 and 73, the mutinies began and spread throughout all branches of the U.S. Armed Forces, from Travis Air Force Base stateside to U.S. Navy ships at sea to Army patrols refusing to patrol to finally reaching the point where even Marines refused to take a hill they had taken and retaken and retaken again ad infinitum ad nauseam. The U.S. Congress finally got the message, loud and clear, and began defunding the American war in Vietnam. Only when the act of mutiny spreads far and wide in the present U.S. military will those mewling war lovers in our present Congress finally get the message and act upon it. I strongly doubt anything else will work given the present conditions where a crime organization rules America. James in Seattle. Yeah, that's one of the aspects of of the end of the war, our invasion of Vietnam, that is not talked about that much. It dare not be talked about. You know, when Bush a couple of weeks ago raised the Vietnam War as an example, he's an ass. He's a total jackass. He has no idea what he's talking about. But the very real possibility does exist. I agree with James in Seattle that the very real possibility exists that finally the soldiers, especially the ones who are on their second, third, and fourth deployment to a war zone, that this resistance is going to develop. I think it's already started, frankly. I had a friend at the time back in late 70 who in the real world was a doctor and got drafted. There was doctor draft. He had been drafted a year earlier, I think, but he was still serving. They gave him the rank of captain, put him in the army, and put him in he didn't work in a field hospital, I don't think. I think he was in, it's hard to remember. We used to send tapes back and forth. Audio tapes. But as a physician, he started telling me stuff that was weird, and he couldn't really come right out and say it, but he started saying that so many of the wounds he was seeing, especially on junior officers, were wounds that, to him, having been in a war zone and doing surgery, he was an emergency room physician, is what he did back in the States. He was seeing war wounds that were caused, and he knew this to be a fact, by U.S. armament. War wounds on our people that were caused by the type and caliber of weapon that U.S. soldiers were using. And they were on the bodies of these junior officers, second lieutenants, first lieutenants, captains. And years later, when he was able to talk, when he was out of the service and came home, that's when I first heard the term fragging from someone who was actually there. I started reading about it late in the war, when junior officers who the soldiers no longer respected, didn't like the war, were sick of it, were tired of it, and they would just drop a satchel explosion into some lieutenant's tent or quarters and bring an end to all that nonsense. So it's just unbelievable. We had a Secretary of Defense and a Commander-in-Chief, I'm talking about McNamara, who worked for Kennedy and then Nixon, then Johnson, who was an absolute psychopath and later admitted it. And then we had a crazed son of a bitch, Richard Nixon, who cared about as much about human life as Bush, and his guy, William Westmoreland, an absolute murderous thug who no more should have been given the kind of power to order people to die then Satan should have been given. So we've seen this before, those of us who are of over a certain age. We've seen this before. The difference being now that we have under 4,000 dead, and by the time this butchery stopped in Vietnam, we had 58,000 dead. And that's just counting Americans. The death rate in Indochina is just a little bit more than the death rate right now in Iraq, for God's sake. That's how much murder we have committed under the control of Rumsfeld, Cheney, Libby, Addington, Bush, and the rest of these monsters. Sandy in Palatine, Illinois writes, Mike, surge my ass. What has to happen to bring our folks home? Betray us is a puppet, just like everyone else in this godforsaken administration. Mike, I did my first ever protest last Saturday on a busy corner of my hometown, the place I grew up in. I have to say it felt good. At first I felt a little funny, but then I really got into it after the car started honking to support our cause. Yeah, we got a few birds tossed our way, but the nun next to me threw them kisses. My little rebellious self wanted to punch them. We are supporting peace, I have to remind myself. I get so emotionally exhausted with everything that goes on in the world. I just thought I would let you know what was going on in the upper north area here. Sandy in Palatine, Illinois. And then there's this. The Newsweek is reporting, there's an internal Pentagon report that contradicts Petraeus' testimony to Congress. Now, in some parts of consciousness, that's called perjury. It's also called someone in the Pentagon has Petraeus' number and is leaking information. But here's what Newsweek says. Newsweek has learned that a separate internal report being prepared by a Pentagon working group will, quote, differ substantially, end quote, from Petraeus' recommendations. An early version of the report, which is currently being drafted and is expected to be completed at the beginning of next year, will, quote, recommend a very rapid reduction in American forces, as much as two-thirds of the existing force, very quickly, while keeping the remainder there. CENTCOM Commander Admiral William Fallon is known to want to draw down faster than Petraeus. Even some supporters of the surge effort wonder whether Petraeus isn't thinking as much about selling the war as winning it. John Arquilla, an intelligence and counterinsurgency expert at the Naval Postgraduate School, is even harsher in his assessment of Petraeus. He says, quote, I think Colin Powell used dodgy information to get us into this war, and Petraeus is using dodgy information to keep us there. His political talking points are all very clear. The continued references he made to the danger of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, for example, even though it represents only somewhere between 2 and 5% of the total insurgency. The continued references to Iran, when in fact the Iranians have had a lot to do with stability in the Shiite portion of the country. And it's not at all clear why things are a little better now. Is it because there are more troops, or is it because we're negotiating with the insurgents and have moved to small operating outposts? On any given day, we don't have more than 20,000 troops operating. And it goes on. This is in, I don't know if this is the current issue of Newsweek or the one about to come out. Now, regarding Admiral Fallon, Fallon is technically Petraeus' boss. Fallon is the head of Central Command. Central Command controls U.S. military operations in the entire Middle East region and the Far East. It's a huge command, and a Navy admiral, the equivalent of a four-star general, is in control, and his name is Admiral William Fallon. Now, this is interesting. During the Iraq War, the Central Command head, that would be Fallon, who leads U.S. operations in the entire Middle East, and the multinational force commander, that would be Petraeus, have regularly testified together about the course of the war in Iraq. Now, Fallon and Petraeus haven't, but the two people prior to these two have. Former MNF Commander General George Casey and his CENTCOM Commander General John Abizade constantly brief Congress about the situation in Iraq and its regional effects. In at least four public hearings after Casey took office in 2004, the pair testified together. In January, Bush replaced Abizade and Casey, who were surge skeptics, with Admiral William Fallon and General David Petraeus. This week, Petraeus delivered his Iraq assessment to great media fanfare. But where was his boss, Admiral Fallon? We have an answer for you when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Condoleezza, check my pussy.
Claire Stavis, Halliburton, mass destruction, me!
Europe is a lovely place to visit. My wife would love to go there every single year. But they're just puppies.
Yep, 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 yep.
They need to shut their yaps. The big dogs over here. I will rule the world forever. I'm straight and white and male, American and free.
Condoleezza, check my pussy.
Bill O'Reilly, Devo Systems, mass destruction, me!
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there? My answer is bring them on.
Bush and Cheney and their thugs have broken the government of this country. They have broken it. We'll have some more on that next hour. Back to Central Command Chief Admiral William Fallon, Petraeus' boss. They have not appeared together in public for these sessions with either House of Congress. Interpress Service suggests animosity between the two might be one reason for Fallon's absence. Fallon told Petraeus back in March that he considered him to be an ass-kissing little chicken blank. An ass-kissing little chicken blank. Fallon told that to Petraeus' face and added, "I hate people like that." That's according to more than one source, and it's being reported all over the Internet and in mainstream media tonight. The remark reportedly came after Petraeus began the meeting between the two by making remarks that Fallon interpreted as trying to ingratiate himself with the superior being Fallon. But this is what Petraeus has always done. This is how he has advanced. He's always been an apple polisher and a suck-up. This is why combat experienced people in the military hate this pissant. This is why real soldiers, whether they're Army or Marines, do not like him. They understand what he is. This is the kind of stuff that never, ever gets out to the public. But Admiral William Fallon calls him an ass-kissing little chicken blank to his face. The Washington Post reported this weekend that there is an internal military debate described as, quote, Armageddon, end quote, brewing between Petraeus and Fallon because the two men have, quote, profoundly different views of the U.S. role in Iraq, end quote. Senator Jim Webb, Democrat of Virginia, announced today that he will be asking Carl Levin, the chairman of that committee, to call Fallon to testify on, quote, his views in the region, end quote. Webb decried the lack of independence in Petraeus' reporting, observing that there are a lot of control factors going on that haven't been visible from the one-sided testimony of Petraeus. Now, Jim Webb would know. Jim Webb, James Webb, was Secretary of the Navy during the Reagan years. He also is a combat veteran. He has a son, I believe, who is in the Marine Corps. I think it's the Marine Corps. They know a stinky, phony rat bastard when they see one. These are the kind of people that got blown into pieces by their own men in Vietnam. It's incredible. Webb went on to say, "It was a very narrow and focused 2 days of hearings. We need to hear from people like Admiral Fallon and others to get a sense of how the region is in play." He was, referring to Petraeus, by many accounts, questioning keeping, or Fallon was questioning keeping those troop levels as high. So I'm going to recommend to Senator Levin that we get Admiral Fallon in and get his views on the region. And again, thanks to our military correspondent for sending that to me. Now, Petraeus' superior, Admiral Fallon, the chief of CENTCOM, got all over Petraeus' ass during that first meeting, referring to him, to his face, as a sycophant during their first meeting in Baghdad last March. That's according to Pentagon sources familiar with reports of the meeting. Interpress News Agency reports the enmity between these two became public knowledge when the Washington Post reported September 9 on intense conflict within the administration over Iraq. The story quoted a senior official as saying that referring to bad relations between these two is, quote, the understatement of the century, end quote. Now, it goes on, this article lays out some of the crap, some of the filthy political. Petraeus is absolutely an insult, like Oliver North, to his uniform. Petraeus is an absolute insult to the uniform, to the flag, to the Constitution he swore to defend and uphold. He's a lying bastard, and he's causing so much death. And Fallon knows it. And Fallon is quoted as saying, let's see, where is it? Here it is. Fallon demonstrated his independence from the White House when he refused this past February to go along with a proposal to send a third naval carrier task force to the Persian Gulf, as reported by Interpress Service in May. Fallon questioned the military necessity for the move, which would have signaled to Iran a readiness to go to war. Fallon also privately vowed that there would be no war against Iran on his watch, implying that he would quit rather than accept such a policy. Now, this is something for all of us tinfoil hat wearers to consider. I realize the talk about an invasion of Iran has been on everybody's lips for several months now. But here you have the man, the Admiral, William Fallon, whose responsibility it would be to carry out an invasion of Iran and oversee that invasion, saying it will not happen on his watch. Interesting. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Welcome back. 6:30 past the hour. Finding out that William Fallon might be, Admiral Fallon is a military man, period. He's a career military officer. Apparently he's hard as nails, and like good military officers, he does not believe in committing troops unless there are several factors in place. A clear objective. Who decides when the battle is over? A withdrawal policy, and, of course, the Bush crime family and these monstrous bastards that have ruined and broken the country have none of that, and neither does Petraeus. Petraeus is an ass-kisser, an apple polisher. That's all he is. And he's in a position now of enormous power, but when you watch this oily rat on television Monday and Tuesday, did you not get the same sense that if you squeezed him, you would get oil all over the floor? William Fallon doesn't like him and has referred to him as an ass-kissing little chicken blank to his face, Fallon. Fallon is Petraeus' boss. Now, a little bit more here, and then I'm going to bring on another freak, Joe Lieberman, who practically begged Petraeus to attack Iran. God, these people just make my skin crawl. Anyway, back to Interpress Service News Agency. Fallon was strongly opposed to Petraeus' role as pitchman for the surge policy in Iraq, adopted by Bush back in December, as putting his own interests, Petraeus's / Bush's, ahead of a sound military posture in the Middle East and Southwest Asia, the area for which Fallon CENTCOM is responsible. That includes Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Syria, Lebanon, Kuwait, the UAE, the Persian Gulf. That's the area that Admiral Fallon has control of, or is responsible for. The CENTCOM commander believed the United States should be withdrawing troops from Iraq urgently, largely because he saw greater dangers elsewhere in the region. A source familiar with Fallon's thinking said, quote, he's very focused on Pakistan and trying to maintain a difficult status quo with Iran. By the time Fallon took command of CENTCOM in March, Pakistan had become, now listen, Pakistan had become the main safe haven for Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda to plan and carry out its worldwide operations. Do you hear that? Pakistan. The country run by a military dictator who is about to be overthrown by religious fundamentalists, a country that has nuclear weapons and will use them because they are religious, insane jackasses. They don't care. Christian fundamentalists, Islamic fundamentalists don't care how many people die. They are both death cults. Both. Pakistan has become the main safe haven for bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, as well as being an extremely unstable state with both nuclear weapons and the world's largest population of Islamic extremists. And Fallon knows this. It goes on, plans for continued high troop levels in Iraq would leave no troops available for other contingencies in the region. Fallon also expressed great skepticism about the basic assumption underlying the surge strategy, which was that it could pave the way for political reconciliation in Iraq. In the lead story, September 9, the Washington Post quoted a senior administration official as saying that Fallon had been saying from day one, this isn't working. Fallon was signaling his unhappiness with the policy of U.S. occupation of Iraq for an indeterminate period. Military sources explained that Fallon was concerned that the concept of a long war would alienate Middle East publics by suggesting that U.S. troops would remain in the region indefinitely. During the summer, according to the Washington Post, Fallon began to develop his own plans to redefine the U.S. mission in Iraq, including a plan for withdrawal of 75% of the U.S. troop strength by the end of 2009. And then it goes on to say, Fallon had a visceral distaste for what he regards as Petraeus's sycophantic behavior in general, which had deeper institutional roots, according to a military source familiar with his thinking. And then this part, Fallon demonstrated his independence from the White House when he refused in February to go along with a proposal to send a third naval carrier task force to the Persian Gulf. Fallon questioned the military necessity for the move, which would have signaled to Iran a readiness to go to war. Fallon also privately vowed that there would be no war against Iran on his watch, implying that he would quit rather than accept such a policy. So there you have it. Now I have to state categorically my complete, total ignorance of Admiral Fallon's positions on any of this stuff. I'm not saying Fallon is a peacenik, although most people in those kinds of positions of command and control see war as a last option, not a first, never a first. They understand what they're dealing with once troops are committed, and bombs and bullets and death and destruction and blowing things up and killing people. Petraeus doesn't, Bush doesn't, Addington doesn't, Cheney doesn't, all these rat bastards who have structured and architected this war do not. Let me play something from you, for you from the hearings the other day with Holy Joe Lieberman, another sociopath whose vice presidential slot on the Gore ticket was forced on Gore by the Democratic Leadership Conference, a completely sold-out, whorish, no offense to sex workers, branch of the Democratic Party. Listen as Joe Lieberman practically begs Petraeus to attack Iran. This was at yesterday's hearings. Lieberman sounds like he's about to cry when Petraeus turns him down.
General, do you feel that you have all the authorities you need from a military point of view to deter, disrupt, and respond to the Iranian attacks on our troops and Iran's efforts to destabilize Iraq?
I do, Senator. Again, keeping in mind that my area of responsibility is limited to Iraq, so it does not include going into Iran.
Let me ask you about that, because I know your military spokespeople in Baghdad have made very clear that we have evidence that Iran is taking Iraqi extremists to three training camps outside of Tehran, training them in the use of explosive, sophisticated weapons, sending them back into Iraq, where they are responsible for the murder of American soldiers. Is it time to give you authority in pursuit of your mission in Iraq to pursue those Iranian Quds Force operations in Iranian territory in order to protect America's troops in Iraq?
Wow. I think that that really the multinational force Iraq should just focus on Iraq, and that any kinds of operations outside the borders of Iraq would rightly be overseen by the central command, the regional combatant command.
I want to just I thank you both. God bless you in your extraordinary service, and we all wish you well and success.
Oh, Holy Joe, what happened?
Senator.
What happened, Holy Joe? He didn't give you the answer he wanted. He did make reference to CENTCOM, though, without bringing up the name of the guy who would like to throw Petraeus' ass on the street, General William Fallon. Sorry, Holy Joe. Aw, what's the matter? You're not going to get your U.S. invasion of Iran? I tell you what, try the Israelis. Maybe they'll respond.
I'm sick of you. I'm sick of you. They arrested the mayor for an illegal favor, sold the Empire State to Japan. And Oliver North married William C. Corden, gave birth to a little Tehran. Ayatollah bought a nuclear warship. If he dies, he wants to go out in style. And there's nothing to eat that don't carry the stink of some human waste dumped in the Nile. But one thing is certainly true: no one here knows what to do. And I'm sick of you. I'm sick of you.
Anyone past the hour. And by the way, Fallon, Jack sent me his bio. You can find it at Wikipedia. Fallon is a graduate of Villanova University, but he received his initial commission through the Navy ROTC. This is not an Annapolis man. This is a guy who advanced through the ranks after being commissioned through the Reserve Officer Training Corps. Not through Annapolis. Very interesting. He holds a master's degree. Petraeus, on the other hand, the apple-polishing twit that he is, I think he is... is Petraeus... I don't even know what service academy he graduated from or came through, but I know he holds a Ph.D. in international relations? So, wouldn't it be... wouldn't it be a kick in the butt to find out that the man holding back the tide of nuclear war is an American admiral? The man saying no behind the scenes quietly to this murderous, filthy Bush administration is Admiral William Fallon. And by the way, he is a four-star admiral, which is high as you can go. In times of war, sometimes I think Admiral Nimitz was a five-star or six-star admiral, but there has to be a war involved. Fallon is as high as you can go, and up until Petraeus sucked up his fourth star, Fallon outranked him. Now they're of equal rank, but Fallon is his Petraeus's immediate supervisor, because Fallon is in charge of all operations, land, sea, and air in that part of the world, as Bush would put it. But wouldn't it be a surprise to find out that Admiral William Fallon was the person who stopped this filthy Bush administration from starting yet a third war? We'll see. And I will add this. Unless the third battle group, naval battle group, was at some point between over the last 4 or 5 months sent to the Persian Gulf, thanks a lot to you hysterical tinfoil hat websites who put out there for all of us on the internet to read that there were three battle groups in the Persian Gulf. Thanks a lot, you jackasses, when it didn't happen at all. I'm not saying that two is good. I'm not saying that one isn't a provocation. But with this kind of global tension and a sociopath in control of the United States, ease up on this crap, will you? You know, so many of these tinfoil hat websites had an invasion of Iraq or Iran July 1st, August 10th, September 11th. You're giving the blogosphere and cyberspace a bad name. You really are. You really are. I have not seen one report by any of these websites, and you know who I'm talking about. You know what sites I'm talking about. That talked about William Fallon saying no to the third battle group. Now, I don't know how he got away with it. And I don't know if another one has been sent. I have no idea. I just know that 4, 5, 6, 3 months ago, 3 weeks ago, within the last week, I've been getting links to these hysterical websites saying, you know, we're right on the verge of war. Nuclear bombs have been loaded onto airplanes in theater. All hell is about to break loose. You know, I'm sitting here going, holy Christ. Maybe not. From John Dean's new book, Broken Government, I got to share this. Do I have time? John Dean writes, as I was writing this closing section, an old friend from the Nixon White House called. Now retired, he's a lifelong Republican who told me that he voted for Bush and Cheney twice because he knows them both personally. He asked how my new book was coming, and when I told him the title, he remarked, I'll say the government's broken. After we discussed it, he asked how I planned to end the book, since the election was still a good distance away. I told him I was contemplating ending mid-sentence and immediately fading to black, the way HBO did in the final episode of The Sopranos, but that I would settle for a nice quote from him on the record. He explained that he constantly has to bite his tongue, and the reason he does not speak out more is because one of his sons is in an important non-political government post. And we both know that Republicans will seek revenge wherever they can find it. All right, I said, how about an off-the-record comment? That he agreed to. And we have a break coming here, so I'll tell you what that off-the-record comment is when we come back from this break. You can pretty much guess, or you can take a guess, who this guy is. Now retired, lifelong Republican, who voted for Bush and Cheney twice because he knows them personally. Who does that sound like? Does that sound like former, what was he, Schultz, what was his first name? Secretary of the Treasury. Served in a couple of administrations, Republicans. You can try to figure it out on your own time, right? I'll have the quote from this guy that appears in John Dean's new book, Broken Government, when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy, this is Nova M.
In the Gulf Coast countries' interest that there be a stable Iran
Iran that is capable of rejecting Iranian influence.
Yeah, okay. All right, John Dean's new book, Broken Government, that has just come out recently. He asked an old friend from the Nixon White House to provide an off-the-record comment regarding George Shultz was the name I was trying to think of, to provide some sort of comment, overview, on the fact that the Bush crime family has broken this government. This is what the unnamed Republican said. Just tell your readers that you have a source who knows a lot about the Republican Party from long experience, that he knows all the key movers and shakers, and he has a bit of advice. People should not vote for any Republican because they're dangerous, dishonest, and self-serving. While I once believed that Governor George Wallace had it right, that there was not a dime's worth of difference in the parties, that is no longer true. I have come to realize the Democrats really do care about people who most need help from government. Republicans care most about those who will only get richer because of government help. The government is truly broken, particularly in dealing with national security. And another 4 years, and heaven forbid not 8 years, under the Republicans, and our grandchildren will have to build a new government, because the one we have will be unrecognizable and unworkable. Holy God. I just wish the Democratic Party leadership was not so damn cowardly. Did not act like a battered spouse constantly. When the police arrive, oh no, that's all right, I don't want to press charges. I've come to realize the Democrats really do care about people who most need help from government. Republicans care most about those who will only get richer because of government help. The government is truly broken, particularly in dealing with national security. And another 4 years under the Republicans, and our grandchildren will have to build a new government because the one we have will be unrecognizable and unworkable. But this Republican insider who says that it is truly broken, particularly in dealing with national security, the one talking point that these rat bastards have tried and succeeded in using as a way of scaring the bejesus out of Americans to vote the pigs in again. And then with the theft of votes and the destruction of ballots cast, these ugly, ugly, filthy subhumans were able to do it to us in 2000, 2002, 2004, 2006. They've got to be stopped. And I hope we can use the ballot box, box 2. I hope we do not have to go to box 4. I hope we don't. All right, let's do some phone calls. Phone number here, oh my God. Oh, I guess there's already people online. Okay, well, I haven't been paying attention, Kathy, I'm sorry. 800-989-1480 is the phone number. Dave is calling from Blaine, Washington, listening via the Internet. Hey, David.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for being there. You know, this is a... God, your show's incredible. This is a lawless occupation. This so-called coalition of the willing, they don't care whether democracy truly sets into Iraq. These Project for New American Century, these clean break demons, you know, would... I could see Iraq, I mean, while listening to your show, I had this revelation that Iraq is being set up as the ultimate staging ground to subdue all of Israel's neighbors, control the oil. I mean, it's so limiting because these weapons of mass destruction, they all run on petroleum. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You cut that off, this military-industrial complex has nothing. And so the dark vision that's described in the Project for New American Century and Netanyahu's clean break, is materializing. In my, from my perspective, it's materializing as we speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you
I think
see,
it,
you see
yeah.
Petraeus and Crocker and Bush and Cheney trying to dump all these different bottles of perfume on the situation, try to, because they've been marketing it and selling it to the American people in a certain way, mm-hmm. in a sterilized, sanitized way, or at least attempting to. You know.
Yes. Yes.
We're not buying it, but you know, this is a bitter pill that we have to swallow and deal with. Because this is a diabolical force unveiling itself right before our eyeballs. And I hope that everybody, you know, is inspired to continue this. It's a silent revolution. The revolution doesn't have to be taken to the streets in a violent way. I mean, because we already know that these Blackwater cronies, you know, that are injecting themselves in peaceful demonstrations, you know, are wanting to disrupt and try to take away or try to squelch the people's voice. But still, that doesn't get rid of the fact that there's been this silent revolution slowly building over the last few decades, even, you know, since before I was born, probably since before you were born onto this world.
Uh-huh.
You see where I'm going with that?
Yeah, I do. I really do, David. Yeah, yeah. I as a matter of fact, what you are saying is probably the first thing in a long time that has made me feel a little bit hopeful that maybe I and you and my children and my grandchildren will not possibly, hopefully, have to take up arms and do what Jefferson suggested. So I appreciate what you're saying. What kind of triggered the hope button in me was what Sharon sent me earlier today about Admiral Fallon. I had no idea.
Incredible.
That this guy felt the way he feels. You never hear this in mainstream media, and you don't read it on the blogs.
And look at all the generals that have already jumped ship because they're smart. You know,
right.
We used to have an honorable, noble military armed forces, and now because of the Abu Ghraib. It's not a scandal. It's a tragedy.
It's horrifying. And none of that stuff happens without either direct orders from up the chain of command,
yep.
or an attitude of we don't care. You know, we may be majors and lieutenant colonels and colonels and brigadiers, but we don't care. Do whatever you want, boys. Have fun. And that kind of attitude, I think that's what has Admiral Fallon willing to call General David Petraeus an ass kisser and a chicken blank that he can't stand and call him that to his face. Because I think Fallon is probably the kind of warrior who looks at what's going on in the military right now and doesn't know whether to resign or I don't know, lead an insurgency of his own. It must be hell. For someone who believes, this is one of the struggles I've had.
Yeah.
And it's one of the struggles that my military correspondent Sharon has had, dedicated to the idea that yes, the military can and has been grossly misused, always by Republicans, occasionally by Democrats, but always by Republicans. And to think that there, in spite of that, there are traditions of glory and honor within the ranks of the United States military that are being just corrupted and stomped on and blasphemed and destroyed by these pigs.
And worn out. I mean, that's why they want to keep sending our troops back, you know, a fourth and a fifth time to wear them out, you know, or the chances of them dying in a roadside bomb increases the more times they're returning. You know, if they did return, you know, they'll have their lifetime benefits denied.
Well, not only that, and you're right, you're absolutely right, but the Bush crime family and the Nixon crime family and the Reagan crime family, these are people who disrespected the military. The Bush crime family especially, they have no use for honor. They have no use for a code of honor or a code of ethics. You know, they want to destroy the military so it can be turned over to private enterprise. There's no honor in private enterprise.
Lawless.
There's no honor in capitalism. There is no honor. There is no code of ethics that can't be totally trashed and destroyed when you turn it over to private corporations. Private corporations will always always have as its first objective and raison d'etre profit. That's all. And it doesn't make any difference if they're digging for oil or murdering people. They don't care.
They don't.
So that's why, the Bush crime family hates the military, because there is still the stench, if you will, of honor about the United States military. There is still the faint echo of bravery and courage and respect for their commitment to protect the Constitution. Bush calls the Constitution a goddamn piece of paper. So tell me, how could he respect the military? I hate these people, David. I hate them to the point that sometimes I think I'm going to blow an artery. But thanks for checking in. You did give me something to think about, the silent revolution thing. Maybe there's some hope.
We're people gonna rise up and take what's there. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the...
The best way to defeat the totalitarian of hate is with an ideology of hope, an ideology of hate.
Such a waste of human DNA, I swear to God. Let me toss this into the mix, then back to your phone calls. The Russian Air Force has tested a giant fuel air bomb, which the military, either ours or those or both, says is the biggest non-nuclear explosive device in the world. Claims that it's bigger than the MOAB, that's a U.S. device of similar destructive power. And experts say, well, okay, that seems possible. It's from Jane's Air Launched Weapons. If you are familiar with Jane's journals on weaponry, this is the Bible of the weapons industry. We have the Massive Ordnance Airburst, the MOAB. But when it was first revealed, we were going to use it in Afghanistan. It was changed to the mother of all bombs, MOAB. The Russian bomb has been named the father of all bombs by its designers. It contains 7 tons of high explosives compared with more than 8 for our MOAB, but it's 4 times more powerful because it uses a new type of explosive developed with the use of nanotechnology. Test results of the new airborne weapon have shown that its efficiency and power is commensurate with a nuclear weapon. And the Deputy Armed Forces Chief of Staff in Russia, General Alexander Rushkin, says it has, quote, no match in the world, end quote. And the editor of Jane's Air Launched Weapons believes that the Russian claims are plausible, given that country's track record in developing and using fuel air devices. The editor told the BBC News, quote, I think the likelihood is that this is the world's largest non-nuclear bomb. The editor says he believes that the test blast, it was tested, was a, quote, statement, end quote, by Russia, comparable in its psychological effect to America's demonstration of the MOAB just before the 2003 invasion of Iraq, a demonstration never followed up by its actual use. We've never used it. But this thing is... there's no point in my going through the shocking description of what happens to the human body in a blast area, but suffice it to say that it liquefies your internal organs and... pretty much incinerates you. just as thoroughly and as completely as a nuclear blast. Now, someone will say in the weapons industry, well, aren't you glad they're going to use these instead of nuclear weapons? The whole thing makes me sick. Jesus, God, it makes me sick. Back to your phone calls. Phil is calling from San Diego, listening on KLSD. Hey, Phil.
Yeah, good evening, Mike.
Hi.
Boy, that was a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, that our last caller, yeah. You mean the bomb thing of the Russians?
No, Dave was really enjoyable, but that thing about the Russians, I mean...
the father of all bombs. Jesus, God. We live in a house of mirrors, a madhouse. I don't know. A carnival midway. It's insane. It's
talk
just,
about Russian dressing.
Yeah, really.
I wanted to just pitch in about this, SB, this scuzz bucket.
Petraeus?
No, Admiral Fallon, man. He's so, talk about a patriot. I mean, this other Petraeus guy, man. Randy Rhodes revealed something that I'm not familiar with of it. I don't know if it's on the internet, but apparently there's like a publication called The Hill. It has to do with the...
Yeah, I'm real familiar. Yeah, I use a lot of their stories, yes.
And I don't know if you've heard about it, but it was towards the end of her show she came out with this because she was totally astonished. She says, well, I mean, this will tell you that with this guy, where this guy Petraeus is coming from, talk about mixing politics with, military work.
Mm-hmm.
2004, he was assisting in the Shrub campaign. So that tells you where he's coming from. You know,
oh, yeah.
Body, soul.
Yeah, I also understand, I've gotten word from somebody, I don't have the email in front of me, but that he's also a religious nutcase that shares the fundamentalist ideas that some of these Christians share with Muslims, and that is everybody else has to die in order for their particular religious crap to rise to the top of the commode. So Petraeus, apparently, I didn't get any independent source where I could check this out, and I usually like to do that before I come on the air with something. But apparently Petraeus is a religious counterpart to Bin Laden. Bin Laden is said in his latest video, if you believe any of that nonsense, that people should all just stop the crap and convert to Islam and everything will be okay. And, of course, that's what these Christian psychopaths also say. Everybody should just stop everything and convert to Christianity and, you know, or either that or provide huge mountains of corpses so that Jesus will be happy one way or the other and come back to earth and say, bless you, my children, now it's time for paradise on earth. So they're all nuts. I mean, every single religious zealot on earth always has been, is, always will be absolutely insane. And apparently that's where Petraeus sits on that continuum.
Yeah, Trader Joe, man, I love that fight that you played because it's like he doesn't even know where the heck he's talking about. He says Iran.
Lieberman
can't make up his mind. You know, it's like,
Lieberman is a religious fanatic. He's an Orthodox Jew of the sort that is just a religious fanatic. He would like to see everybody dead. Or sedated, except people in Israel. And he stinks. I mean, he just stinks. Thanks, Phil. I got to leave it there. I appreciate it. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. Your phone calls when we come back. The number here is 800-989-1480. Got a couple open lines, so fill them up. I'm Mike Malloy. This is the Nova M Radio Network. Oh, yeah. And some Tony Snow when we come back. Woo!
Midnight choir, I have tried in my way.
Welcome back. About 7 past the hour. Okay, Mike sent some info in here. First of all, regarding Petraeus, this is from Wikipedia. Upon promotion to Lieutenant Colonel, Petraeus moved from the office of the Chief of Staff to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where he commanded the 101st Airborne Division, 3rd Battalion, 187th Infantry Regiment, from 1991 to 1993. Now, remember what was going on then. Right. Nothing. As battalion commander, well, there was a Somalia thing, thanks to George Herbert Gerbert Bush, but as a battalion commander of the Iron Rakasans, he suffered one of the more dramatic incidents in his career when in 1991 he was accidentally shot in the chest during a live fire exercise when a soldier tripped and his rifle discharged. He was taken to Vanderbilt University Medical Center, Nashville, Tennessee, where he was operated on by the future Senator Bill Frist. The hospital released him early after he did 50 push-ups without resting just a few days after the incident. And Mike adds, apart from the above, it seems as though Petraeus has never been involved in a military conflict. Admiral Fallon, on the other hand, and again, I'm not trying to put too much, you know, I may be grasping at straws here with Admiral William Fallon. I don't know, maybe I am. But to hear someone make a statement categorically in the face of the chain of command, he sits at the top of the chain, but not all the way at the top, that an invasion of Iran is not going to happen on his watch. He said that. He's on the record with that. And he also thinks Petraeus is what I've been saying all night. I don't want to say it again because it gets very close to the line about what's allowed, what I'm allowed to say on this program in terms of profanity and what I'm not allowed to say. But Fallon has clearly identified Petraeus as a punk, an absolute punk. But Fallon has served in Vietnam. He served in the Serbian War, I believe, and also in, was he in Iraq One? I don't know. General Anthony Zinni, Marine General, former head of Central Command. The one whom Fallon succeeded, I believe. Zinni is on the record as saying it's pretty interesting that all the generals who were in combat see it the same way, and all the others who have never fired a shot and are hot to go to war see it another. We're about to do something that will ignite a fuse in this region that we will rue the day we ever started. And he said that prior to the invasion of Iraq. And Anthony Zinni, of course, was absolutely right. You don't talk to a Marine officer who has been in combat and expect that Marine officer to say to you, yeah, let's go kick some ass. Yeah, let's go invade a country. Yeah, let's start a war. Let's start another one. Let's start a third one. You only hear that from the punks and the apple polishers. And as Fallon referred to Petraeus, the ass kissers. Wow. And Bush tomorrow night? Oh, my God. It's going to be a hosing, truth seekers. Get ready for it. Have your disinfectant ready because Bush is going to come out there spewing feces all over whatever room he speaks in, all over whatever audience is in that room, and all over the airwaves. It's just going to be an absolute blank storm. Fecal storm. Oh, God. I really like using cuss words. I really do. They're so descriptive. You know, for semi-literates like me, they're just so descriptive. Well, back to your phone calls. William is calling from Hollywood, listening on the internet, Hollywood, California. William, welcome to the program. Hey, William. Uh oh. Hold on, William. We've got a serious phone problem here. We're going to put you on hold, and let's see if our crack engineer Ian can straighten that out. We'll come back to you in a second. Sue is calling from Oakland Park, Florida, listening on WINZ. Hey, Sue.
Hi, Mike. Last night, PBS stations aired an amazing documentary. I think you personally are going to love it. It's called the Camden 28.
Camden 28.
It was part of the series POV. You can find out more at pbs.org/POV.
Okay.
Find out when it's going to re-air on Saturday in your area in Atlanta, Channel 8. It's 4:30 in the morning. Set your VCRs and your DVRs and your TiVo for it. It was the synopsis from the POV bulletin says, "How far would you go to stop a war?" And it's about a 1971 act of civil disobedience against a draft board.
Oh, this is where they took in their own blood?
No, that's not the one, but
no.
It involved, it's kind of a blueprint for all mm-hmm. the people who call in and want to know what they can do to stop this. Maybe they can get some ideas from this film.
And it's called The Camden 28.
The Camden 28, part okay. of POV.
Right.
And most PBS stations will re-air it probably in the overnight hours on Saturday.
Okay.
It is what people of conscience, which I hope I am one of, and people of faith, which I am not, can do to peacefully commit acts of civil disobedience to help bring about the end of an unjust war.
Mm-hmm.
And the parallels with Iraq, like all of Vietnam, are incredible, because you watch this documentary and it's about Vietnam, but you're thinking Iraq the whole time.
Right.
And the amazing thing is that these people, 36 years later, when they catch up with these people that were involved and were tried, and I won't reveal the ending, but mm-hmm. 36 years later, they're out protesting in the streets against the Iraq War.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just watch it if you can and spread the word, please. I have no financial or any other interest in this documentary or the filmmaker or any connection to it. I was just blown away by it.
Sure. All right. Well, you've just put the word out, and I'll try to watch it this weekend. Thanks,
okay.
Thanks a lot, Sue. I appreciate it. Take care. Let's try William again. William, are you there now?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay, now we can hear you. Hey.
It was my wonderful cordless phone, I think.
I'll bet it was.
Yes. You know, I was, that first caller you had, his name is David, I believe.
Yes, uh-huh.
And, you know, you were talking about something similar last week about, you know, hope, your last only hope would be that the military would take control of this situation.
Right, put a stop to it, right.
Right. And, you know, I was, he gave me some hope, and then, you know, when I heard about the Russian bomb thing, it just took that right away. You know, I just can't imagine what kind of people we have in this, on this planet, that go for a career to build weapons to destroy life. You know, when I think about these people down in the bowels of the earth, experimenting and building bombs. You know, in Russia with this new one, the United States with this one, and if they can't make one, we give them one, you know, like Pakistan for, what was it, mangoes?
Mm-hmm, or something.
Yeah, and Lieberman, I mean, I can't imagine how the rest of even the Republicans just on Lieberman, just the way he is alone, just the way he looks to me, I would vote just to end this whole war right now, just in spite of Lieberman, if I was a Republican. I mean, the guy's a freak.
He really is. Lieberman has totally lost it. Maybe it was the Harry Thunderer or Cosmic Hoo-Ha who was watching over America and refused to allow Lieberman into the office of the vice presidency. He might have been worse than Cheney. Lieberman is single-minded, though. There is only one issue for him, and that is the sovereignty throughout the entire Middle East of the State of Israel. That's Lieberman's issues, top to bottom. Anything else that he does is secondary to his dedication and his allegiance to the state of Israel. He will advocate for and lobby for and try to fund any military operation, no matter how much it costs U.S. Treasury in lives or in money, or how much it costs the American public in lives, as long as it benefits Israel. Lieberman is single-minded. There is no other issue to Lieberman except the sovereignty of Israel in the Middle East. William, I have to leave it there. Thank you. I appreciate you checking in, pal. Take care. We'll talk again. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
In megatons, well, who's left when the war is won? A soldier of a misfortune, a soldier of an angry call, soldiers on foreign soil. Well, we're not here to fight your war, 'cause we know what you're fighting for.
Reality Radio for a Rational World. The Mike Malloy Show, only on Nova M Radio.
22 past the hour. In addition to the Camden 28, there's another film you might want to say, and Chris in Indianapolis reminds me. He writes in, Mike, you mentioned on your show that everyone above a certain age has seen this all before. In he's referencing Vietnam versus Iraq. Chris writes, for those of us who are too young to remember Vietnam, I was born in 1969, he writes, there is a wonderful documentary which I'm sure you've seen many times, the Oscar-winning Hearts and Minds. Yeah, it's incredible. Chris writes, it's a great example of a narrator-less documentary that is both poignant and direct. The clips of General Westmoreland speak volumes about his character. The evil just shines through. As a documentary producer myself, I strongly recommend this film to all of your listeners. It's especially interesting to watch in the context of the 21st century. The parallels are obvious. We can only hope that our current period in history will someday be as well documented. Yeah, if you haven't seen, thanks Chris, if you haven't seen Hearts and Minds, and it's been a long time since I've seen that, Kathy, we need to take another look at that. I swear to God. And then the documentary of, what's his name, McNamara's, that's not the same one, is it? No. The movie that came out where, what? The Fog of War, that's what I'm thinking of, thank you. When I watch Fog of War and I see this pathetic old man, Robert McNamara, who at one time was so young, so vibrant, so dedicated, so determined, so sure of his war plans for Vietnam, and now a broken husk of a man who's, what, approaching 90? He's passed away, hasn't he? Hasn't he died? I don't know. But that movie, The Fog of War, was shocking. But Hearts and Minds, yeah, you got to see it. Back to your phone calls. Marilyn is calling from Miami, listening on WINZ. Hi, Marilyn.
Oh, hi, Mike. I was listening to Wesley Clark Jr. tonight.
Uh-huh.
And he was interviewing an investigative reporter named Rick Wiles. And this guy is really concerned about the Air Force being grounded this Friday. And I was wondering if you know anything about it.
I don't. I know that October 15th through the 20th, there's going to be something called Vigilant Shield 2008. It's a North American Aerospace Defense Command, that's NORAD, and U.S. Northern Command sponsored exercise for Homeland Defense. But I know what's happening this Friday.
It's supposed to be in response to the six nukes that were flying over accidentally, you know, the mistaken. the mistake of the six nuclear warheads were flying from the one camp, from the one place to the other. I can't do the story justice, but I just wanted to tell you the guys, the investigative reporter's name is Rick Wiles, and he thinks it's nefarious, the whole thing. He wants to know why on earth the military would be announcing this, that they're laying down, you know, that they're cutting back and are doing this grounding. They call it a stand down, which means that there's going to be like, I think you said like 100,000.
I'm sorry. Now I know what you're talking
about. I'm not making myself clear. I'm sorry.
No, it's me. It's too late. I'm not thinking clearly. This is the stand down was ordered to find out how these nukes got loaded onto the planes and flown to Louisiana.
But that means that like all those men are not gonna, all those soldiers, whatever the Air Force are called, are not going to be readily available, doesn't it?
It means that for sure, a general stand down is where people who are in the active military, in a sense, and this is not the right terminology, but in a sense, take a break and sit down with a unit commander who goes over the rule book with them again. Everybody knows the rules of engagement. Everybody knows procedures on how to handle, for example, nuclear weapons. And when you have an incident like the one that occurred last week, if it was in fact an accident, then a stand down is in order. If it was not an accident, then a stand down is perfect cover to pretend like they're reviewing the rules. But that's what that is, Marilyn. To announce it publicly, is kind of risky, wouldn't you think? I think. Marilyn, thanks. We have a break here. Tony Snow, when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
Baby, your love's gone. I'm tired of fighting. I'm tired of fighting. Fighting for love.
Ready for Radical Talk Radio? Make mine Mike Malloy on Nova M.
It's about 25 before the hour. Today was the snowman's last day in the White House press room. We're going to play for you a couple of sound bites here from that final briefing. He's going to be replaced by too much cappuccino Perino. Can't wait to see how Spinderella plays out the final days of the Bush administration. I'm sure that it's going to be a hoot. If it weren't for the fact that we're talking about death and destruction, it would be actually funny. Here's Tony Snow.
This job has been the most fun I've ever had, the most satisfying, fulfilling job. I'm sorry I have to leave it. But I have got to say, it has been a real honor and a pleasure working with everybody in this room. And I'll miss it. I everybody talks about what a horrible job it is to brief the press. I love these briefings, and I'm really going to miss them. On the other hand, it's left in Dana's capable hands, and the business of keeping the press informed will continue to be the object of the press office, and life will continue, including for me.
Well, let's hope. If it's been such a pleasure working with everybody in this room, as you put it, Tony, why lie? Why all the lies? It's one thing to be a Ron Nessen or what was his name? Who was the Bush's first press secretary? Ari Fleischer. You know, people the core of whom is based on lies. That's one thing. But Jesus, Tony, we're in a horrible situation here. Instead of lying, instead of spinning so fast that your head almost came off, why didn't you ever tell us the truth if it was so much fun? Or was that the part that was fun? Being able to stand in front of America and lie your ass off. Now, as far as your statement, on the other hand, it's left in Dana's capable hands, and the business of keeping the press informed will continue. What? Keeping the press informed? No. Keeping the press filled with nonsense, misdirection, half-truths, untrue statements, and flat-out lies. Come on, Tony, for God's sake, when do you make peace with your maker? When do you have... I've said it before. When do you have your Lee Atwater moment? Now, after all the niceties and goodbyes were taken care of, the briefing, turned to the Petraeus report and Bush's upcoming major speech on Iraq tomorrow night. This reporter says, Tony, Speaker Pelosi said that General Petraeus' strategy amounts to a strategy for endless war. That would be a war without end, wouldn't it? What's the administration's view, Tony? How do you answer that charge?
It's pretty clear that it's not a war without end. As a matter of fact, it is a war that actually has victory as its aim. And victory is defined as helping the Iraqis develop the capability of defending themselves and governing themselves.
Oh, okay.
And what's happening is that there's an attempt to say, if you don't have the crystal ball and you can't tell us when you're going to leave, it's an open-ended commitment. The Speaker Pelosi knows perfectly well that the American people are going to draw judgments as well on the facts on the ground. What I'm arguing is you might want to take the blinders off and take a look at what's going on, because there have been significant improvements. And maybe part of the important addition to this debate is celebrate the troops,
they've done,
give them some congratulations for success, and ask the simple question, what do you need to succeed?
Oh, my God. They always do that, don't they? These Republican coward asses always do it. Well, listen, there's a lot of atrocities, death, destruction, lies, deceit, dishonor, unethical behavior, but hey, celebrate the troops. What's the matter? Don't you love America, you son of a bitch? Celebrate the troops. What are you, liberal? You pig. I'd like to celebrate the troops with a big homecoming party. And you know what, Tony? I think they'd like that too. You know, I really do. And now victory is defined as helping the Iraqis develop the capability of defending themselves and governing themselves. This is the 137th definition of victory in Iraq. This is why we're there. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And he insists, doesn't he? There have been significant improvements. Where, Tony? Where? Next reporter, April Levine, asked Foxy if the Bush crime family said the counterinsurgency was working. Does that mean we're winning the war? She says, you said the counterinsurgency strategy is working. You're saying it's a success. Many critics of this war and those who have even supported the war have said this war cannot be won militarily. Does this mean that at this point the U.S. military is winning in Iraq?
General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker both pointed out that this is not going to be won strictly militarily. I got a question earlier from John about other parts of the U.S. government. Military helps resolve security issues and go after those who are trying to destabilize the government through violence and insurgency. On the other hand, you have to build the capability to have a stable civil society. That means protecting human rights, develop civil society, of which, you know, the president's received a number of reports on those, and those seem to be producing some pretty good results.
Are we winning? Is the U.S. military winning right now?
Is the U.S. military winning right now? This is not the U.S.'s war to win or lose.
Well, let's come home, then!
Ultimately, it is the Iraqi people.
Oh, my God!
They're going to have to stand up to the insurgents and have to develop the political will to succeed. It is not going to. The U.S. military is never going to, quote, win the war, but it can create conditions in which the Iraqis can go ahead and establish a government.
Goodbye, Tony. Oh, God, we're going to miss you. Oh, you lying thug. What does he say? Is the U.S. military winning the war? That means acknowledging, recognizing, protecting human rights? The Sunnis and the Shia? Something that will never, ever, 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 ever occur in Iraq? We have organized death squads of Sunnis and Shia. We want them to kill each other. You lying bastard, right up to the last minute. Right, Tony? The last thing out of your mouth is going to be a lie. And you say that this sectarian murder, this 200 dead here, 300 dead there, blasts all over the country, car bombs going off. You say this seems to be producing some pretty good results? And the reporter says, Again, are we winning? Is the U.S. military winning right now? This is not the U.S.'s war to win or lose. Oh, that's right. We just start the wars. We wreak havoc. We trash economies. We kill people. We destabilize societies. We overthrow governments. We execute the leaders. And then we expect the ravaged nation to put itself back together. And if they don't, well, the sons of bitches just won't step up to the plate. Right, Tony? So let me get this straight. Tony says the U.S. military is never going to win the war. Okay, we're going to succeed and have victory, but we're not going to win. Oh, my God. This has got to be, and has been, and will be, for whatever history we have left, one of the worst foreign policy mistakes this country has ever, ever made. And these lying rat bastards continue to ride this dead horse. So we're going to leave Foxy the Snowman with his final Q&A. Tony seems to be channeling another dearly departed member of the Bush crime family, former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Reporter says, Tony, you said earlier that some of the benchmarks are not that important. Does the president also believe, like you do, that some of the benchmarks are not that important?
I didn't say that. I said if you take a look at the report itself, it says that some of the benchmarks, at least at this juncture, are not entirely appropriate and do not necessarily measure. The president thinks these are a commitment we made. We made a commitment to take a look at the benchmarks. Are they the whole story in Iraq? No. Are they important for considering what's going on in Iraq? Yes. Would you limit your reporting to 18 questions that have been put together by Congress months ago? No. You would ask yourself, what are the full pictures? So what you do is you start with the notional picture that's created by the benchmarks, and you move forward.
Sounded like Rumsfeld in that answer.
Did I really?
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
There are no knowns, and what do you know that some cannot know is that this time next year, if there is indeed another year we could call next, which I'm not claiming there is or isn't, is that the metrics by which I calculate my annual wage will be many multiples of my current salary as a federal employee. Goodbye, Tony. Oh, my God. So we're not going to have Tony Snow to kick around anymore. Who was the guy right before Tony, that the Pillsbury Doughboy? What was his name? Simple Scotty. Scott McClellan, that's right. Whatever happened to the Pillsbury Doughboy? Do you have any idea, Kathy? Ari Fleischer, we know, has become a salivating, drooling, pro-war freak who exploits veterans who have had their arms and legs blown off so that more veterans will be produced to have their arms and legs blown off. But what about the Pillsbury Doughboy?
He either left to spend more quality time with Jeff Gannon or a cruller. I'm not sure.
I see. All right. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Stay with us. You know, when that song was popular, if that's the right word, 3 decades ago, almost 4, I thought to myself, you know, Jesus, what time in a nation's history produces that kind of lament? Thanks to our engineer, Ian Huff, who put the show together tonight. He also answered your phone calls. Ian operates out of our flagship station for Nova M Radio Network, KPHX in Phoenix. Thanks to Billy Foster, our chat room moderator. Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent. Everybody who contributed emails and articles to the program, I wish I had a chance to acknowledge everything that comes in here. You folks are a great research resource. And sitting over the top of that, and this really gets me. You folks will never meet, not in any realistic sense. Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent, and then all the folks who also contribute to this program. Thank you very much. Our executive producer is Catherine Bay. Okay, who do we have here? Wilson is calling from Fort Myers, Florida, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Wilson.
Hey, I made it. I'm a star.
There you go.
Boy, I don't know. You know, I'm not Mensa material. You know, I'm no good genius. I can't even get on your website. I keep forgetting my passwords. They block me. But I don't understand why the whole time they're leading up to this Petraeus thing, everybody already apologizing how we have nothing against Petraeus. Petraeus is a good man. He's a decent man. He'd never lie to us. You know, Democrats are saying that. Now they bring this thing up on September 11th. What kind of baloney is that? They're going to have the trial of us being in Iraq. We're talking about getting the hell out of Iraq on September 11th. And they go for it. Nobody brings that up. And nobody says anything about the hundreds of thousands of people that we've just blown out of their homes. They're sitting in refugee camps in Jordan and every place. It's disgusting, and nobody says anything. They're too busy kissing General Petraeus because he's such a good man.
Well, I think part of the reason the Democrats don't call it like it is, he's an apple polisher, he's an ass kisser, and he's a liar, is because the Democrats are terrified. They're terrified that if they ever speak the truth, they're afraid it'll be captured on some kind of an audio tape that'll be played on YouTube or on the Pigman Rush Limbaugh's program, and that maybe they'll lose their election the next time they come up, or it'll be used in a campaign ad against them. So the Democrats, like I said earlier in the program tonight, I said before, they're like battered spouses.
Why the hell aren't the Republicans? Why aren't they
scared? Oh, well, stop. Republicans couldn't care less. Republicans don't believe in service to America.
But they want to get elected.
That's only so they can be like pigs and slop at the trough. That's all that's about, Wilson.
But why aren't they frightened like the Democrats? Why do they just go ahead and say whatever the hell they want and they still get in? They still get in office.
Well,
Democrats learn something from that.
Well, no, because Democrats will not use, most of them will not use fear the way the Bush crime family has used fear as its only motivating aspect for the past 6 years. Democrats are not into fear. Democrats are into trying to solve problems until we wound up with a leadership like we've got that is absolutely just reeking of cowardice. I hope it soon stops. I hope Democrats...
God, I hope you're right. It sounds like the only one we can count on now is like Webb and maybe your admiral there.
Fallon.
And then if that doesn't work, we're screwed.
Yeah, well, there's some more. The problem, Wilson, is so many of the Democrats that are speaking the truth are just not in positions of power. And that means in media-driven America, they don't exist. And that's a shame. Thanks, Wilson. I appreciate you checking in. Julian is calling from Houston, Texas, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Julian.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I was thinking about this Iraq war. You know, you think about it, democracy doesn't help out, you know, our corporate interest over there. There's no way they can exploit Iraq for all its oil if there's a democracy installed.
Absolutely true. It's democracy in name only. It is a puppet government that will have had Bush's murderous plan worked, had some of the illusion, sort of a Potemkin democracy, had an illusion. Well, we got a parliament. Well, we have two houses of parliament. Well, we have a no, that's not democracy. Democracy is all the institutions that has taken 230 years to build in this country, and hundreds, if not thousands, of years to build in other countries. There's no such thing as democracy in Iraq. Not then. Not now. Not tomorrow. Not ever. The only time. No, never mind. There's never been democracy in Iraq, and there never will be.
I mean, like in Iran in the 50s, they had a democracy, and they didn't agree with the oil contract that BP gave them. They just had America remove the president and install the Shah.
Right. Well, I wouldn't call it democracy. Their president, Mohammad Mossadegh, was elected by the parliament. And as far as Iran itself, keep in mind, that was Persia. Iran never existed until after... after World War I, and Iran was one of the countries that formed an alliance with the Nazis in Germany. So I'm not knocking down what you said, because I've said it a million times. We overthrew their government, and for the very reason you said, because they were going to nationalize their own oil. But Iran is, that was never a democracy either. You can't have democracy unless the people in the country you're focusing on come out of the 13th or 14th century. And so many of these countries have not. They believe in Islamic law. They believe in Sharia. They believe that, if a woman doesn't dress in a burqa, cut her head off. You can't have democracy like that. You really can't. Hey, listen, thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in, Julian. We're out of time. Thanks for participating in the program tonight, however you did that, okay? Hi, take care. Oh, God, tomorrow's Thursday. Thank you. I'll see you tomorrow night. Do take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.